Oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Continental Casualty Insurance Company versus Functional Restoration Association and others from Travis County. Emilio Urrutia and others versus Sparrow Decker from Harris County. And Phi Delta Theta versus Edward Lockwood Moore III from Harris County. In each of these matters, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. All of these arguments are being recorded by the clerk, and you may purchase a tape of an argument for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Continental versus Functional.
May it please the court. Mrs. Jane Lipstein Stone and Mr. John Pringle will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mrs. Lipstein Stone will present the first 10 minutes. Mrs. Lipstein Stone will also present the rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. The legal issues involved in this workers' compensation case are important to the judicial review of Texas administrative decisions in the state in general. These legal issues also call for thoughtful consideration by this court of substantive due process issues, implications involving separations of powers, and the integrity of the workers' compensation system. When the legislature enacted the new Workers' Compensation Act, they did something that hadn't been done before. They gave workers in Texas the entitlement to lifetime medical benefits. In exchange for this, they also implemented a regulatory system to regulate the cost effectiveness, the cost effectiveness of the health care that the workers are receiving, and put into place checks and balances for treatment guidelines so that the care would be medically necessary and appropriate for the treatment of their injuries. When they did this, it would be difficult to believe that they simply forgot to provide for judicial review of these property rights that were involved with the parties. In the Continental case, as you're well aware, the right involved is the right to the money that was ordered, the Continental Casualty was ordered by the Workers' Compensation Commission to pay to Functional Restoration Associates in Prime. For the injured workers, the demand for the entitlement for health care benefits would be a similarly important protected right under the Texas Workers' Compensation Act. Could it possibly be true that the legislature simply forgot to provide for a right review in the statute?
Doesn't seem that it's not true they forgot, but they intentionally created a system for review of medical benefits with regard to benefits claimed by claimants, and that's contained in Chapter 410. But when it comes to disputes between, say, an insurance company and a healthcare provider, and the interplay they may have with regard to the commission, they decided that for those types of matters, they were not going to provide judicial review. And that's what's contained in Chapter 413, which is wholly separate and was seemingly intentionally created to be separate by the legislature.
Continental Casualty disagrees, Your Honor, because of the structure of the act as it was implemented.
Well, looking at the structure of the act, if you tell me anything in Chapter 410 that provides recovery by an insurance company, if you look at Chapter 410, it all speaks to proceedings that involve recovery or a contest of recovery by a claimant.
Would respond, Your Honor, that section doesn't preclude carriers from participating in recovery.
Cite me a provision in 410. You can't, can you?
No, I can't cite you a provision in 410, Your Honor.
Okay.
Statutory right of review, we believe, is apparent when you look at the pre-codification version of the statute. 6.62A and 6.64 are the most important provisions to look at. 6.62A is what we believe became, after codification, Section 410.301 and 410.255 that you're questioning. According to the sponsor of the bill, medical benefits disputes were intended to be in a catch-all provision that appears in Section 6.64, the issues other than. And those issues other than are benefit issues. We've heard the commission in its brief argue repeatedly that there are other provisions of the Act that require that provide for judicial review expressly. None of those provisions that they cite, however, such as extra hazardous employer designation, have anything to do directly with workers' compensation benefits. It would be redundant, in fact, for the legislature to have provided express judicial review in those statutes if those were to be considered under 410.255. The only other than issues, therefore, that make sense to be included in 410.255 are issues involving benefits to injured workers. One of those issues, the very important one in this case, is medical benefits, the only issue not expressly addressed for judicial review.
But again, you seem to be either unable to or unwilling to draw a distinction between a dispute, say, by a claimant for medical benefits provided to a claimant, separate from a dispute between an insurance company and a health care provider concerning medical benefits. Why would you refuse to accept that distinction, other than the fact that it would hurt your case?
I accept that there's a distinction, Your Honor, between the two, but I do believe that both injured workers and carriers can recover for whatever wrong done to them, whether it's a refund to an injured worker for a payment made when they indeed suffered a compensable injury, or if it's a carrier trying to recover from a provider, for example, in a refund situation. 413, Your Honor, provides for a dispute resolution of medical benefit disputes, whether it's insurance carriers or injured workers or providers. All three may go under that subject.
Have you noticed that under Section 413, it never discusses the claimant, and never discusses any claims or remedies for a claimant?
I didn't really notice that, Your Honor, but I know in practice that a claimant does come in under Section 413 many times. That specifically would be a time when an injured worker has made a payment for a health care benefit and it's later determined that his injury was compensable. He would come in under 413 requesting a refund for an overpayment, just as a carrier would if he had simply paid the health care bill.
You don't by chance have all of Section 410 handy, do you?
No.
If you would look under Section 410, one key focus of your argument is 410.255.
Yes, sir.
And you want to view this whole thing in the concept of the way that the whole Workers' Comp Act or Labor Code is structured. And if you look at, you know, this title concerns adjudication of disputes. If you look at all the sections preceding and following 410.255, they all involve types of claims that are totally unrelated to the type of claim we have here. Like, look at 410.256 about the court approving a settlement made by the party. And you can tell by reading that that relates, for example, look at 410B1, which talks about, or B2, throughout there it talks specifically about the claimant. And the same thing pertains to the adjudication disputes in that same subchapter with regard to 410.252. Like filing a petition, here's a classic example. With regard to filing the petition, under this particular subchapter, if you look at 410.252, which to me seems to have close interplay with 255, it talks about where the suit could be filed, the suit that you want to be able to bring. And it has to be filed where in the county where the employee resided at the time of the injury or death, or in the case of an occupational disease in the county where the employee resided on the date the disability began. When you have a dispute between an insurance carrier and a health care provider, I submit to you that the location of the injured worker is fairly irrelevant with regard to where the venue should be.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any response to that?
I don't think well, let me give you an example. There are also provisions in here, quite frankly, I've forgotten to sign, for subclaim status during this very type of dispute for healthcare providers. For example, a healthcare provider can come in under the 410 series and request a benefit review conference, a contested case hearing. They can go to district court after going to the appeals panel in the shoes of the injured worker. That is a case where a healthcare provider can indeed follow those provisions.
And I frankly agree with you completely, because but it's limited to situations where it specifically involves benefits that may be owing to a claimant, as opposed to the fight between the insurance carrier and the health care provider over whether or not the insurance carrier really has to pay those claims.
Yes, Your Honor, a similar situation would arise if a refund request by he does have to go through, or in practice, goes through Section 413 of the dispute resolution process to a co-payment. There's no question that there's a great deal for we've now confusion about that, even though the commission in its own orders on these cases puts at the bottom of that he may seek judicial review by filing a petition in Travis County District Court within 30 days of receiving the petition.
Well, let's say 410 says what you claim it says, or means what you claim it means. Isn't 413, at least with regard to the medical review benefits provision, just kind of totally silly for the legislature to have created, because there is no reason for it to even exist?
No, Your Honor, it's not totally silly, because you're dealing with issues that involve complex regulatory issues when you're talking medical benefits. For example,
why would 410.255 apply and all the other adjudication of disputes contained in all of the subchapter of 410 not govern all of that, which would render that section 413 totally meaningless, totally surplus?
They could have done that. Instead, what the legislature elected to do was set up a division of medical review who would specifically be charged with enforcing the medical fee guidelines and treatment guidelines, such as the signed treatment guidelines, which are rules promulgated by the commission to implement the regulations of the Act to balance the award of lifetime medical benefits to the claimants. It's a very specialized area of practice. The medical review division has the two levels where you do a paper review, and the medical review division has a chance to apply its own guidelines and rules and issue a decision without a hearing. Then there's a chance for SOA, used to be the commission before the hearings went over to SOA, to review the agency's application of its own rules and its own treatment guidelines, Your Honor. I would propose that the legislature split that intentionally so that you could have very efficient and separate adjudication of compensability issues so that a worker who's injured in Texas can have a quick determination of whether he suffers a compensable injury. Most disputes that arise after that determination is made over the life of the claim will likely involve medical benefits issues.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I'd like you to do something for me. Imagine I'm the attorney for James Hood. And imagine that James Hood, who sustained an on-the-job injury, wanted to give medical treatment for his injuries so he could return to work or so it would relieve him from the effects of the injury. Continental Casualty Company refuses to pay for that treatment. So James Hood goes to the Workers' Compensation Commission's medical review, and they refuse to order payment. So James Hood asks for a hearing before the State Office of Administrative Hearings. And that ALJ, the Administrative Law Judge, listens to the argument from the Workers' Compensation Commission's attorney and refuses to order payment for treatment. So James Hood then says, gee, do I have a right of judicial review of that decision? I believe this court answered that in the affirmative in the Workers' Compensation Commission versus Garcia. This court said there was a right of judicial review. The question was, what was the method of review? Is it trial?
Can I stop you? But I mean, it seems clear that there is, and that's provided under either 410.301 or 410.255.
I believe, Your Honor, it's under 410.255.
Again, but you're talking about the claimant seeking recovery as opposed to the insurance company having a dispute with regard to the health care provider, not over whether or not the claimant gets any benefits.
Well, Michael, the medical benefit is a benefit under the Workers' Compensation Act. My clients are health care providers. They provide a treatment to James Hood. They should have the same right. I believe the Act clearly states they do have the same right to seek judicial review. If you look...
If that's the case, then explain to me, if 255 covers what you say it does, I simply do not understand why 413.031, especially D, exists. There's no reason for the legislature to have wasted their time writing.
I believe I have an answer for
okay.
you. And interrupt me if you don't think I'm covering it. I think it goes back to how the Act was passed. Initially, if you look at the legislative history of the Workers' Compensation Act, originally there was no bifurcation or the hybrid method of review, so to speak, as the San Antonio Court of Appeals now. What the court originally had was you were going to have Administrative Procedure Act hearings of all disputes before the Workers' Compensation Commission. In the course of the second session, you had the legislation change where you suddenly had the appeals panel created on the income, death benefits, and compensability issues. And they left the system the way it had originally been proposed for all other disputes. So you have your benefit review conference in 410, your contested case hearing. You then go to the appeals panel, and because of the concern about trial de novo, because that was the issue that was before this court, in my opinion, in the Garcia case, they created a limited method trial de novo for the injured worker on compensability, income, and death benefits. But for all other disputes, they left it with the Administrative Procedure Act method of judicial review and hearing. And that's why you see in 413.031, it says a party. You ask my co-counselor, or I should say my colleague, well, where in 413.031 does it say the health care provider? It doesn't say the claim. It doesn't say the health care provider. It doesn't say someone else. It says a party.
Well, it says a party, comma, including a health care provider.
That's correct, to make sure that it was very clear that any party has a right to a hearing. Your Honor, if you
would
look,
that be also meaning insurance company?
It means insurance company to Your Honor. If you look, Your Honor, at the law before it was put in the labor code, under the article 8308, if you go to the section, I'm going to call it chapter 6, it's, I think, a little bit clearer. You talk about the methods of review under, I believe it's 6.61, 6.62, and 6.63. You then come down to 6.64, which is now 410.255, and it says all other issues. All other issues. It doesn't say all other issues from the appeals panel. It says all other issues go up under substantial evidence. Your Honor, if you look at 401.021 of the Act, it says that the Administrative Procedures Act, subchapter G, which is the judicial review provisions, applies to every hearing or proceeding.
The Court of Appeals didn't buy the argument that you and your colleague are making on statutory interpretation. Instead, determined that because of the property interest, there's an inherent right to judicial review. In what way does the administrative procedures that are in the Act fail to give all the process that is due?
Your Honor, at that time, that hearing was heard before a contested case hearing officer at the Workers' Compensation Commission. Now they're before the State Office of Administrative Insurance. You did not have at that time the procedures available under the Administrative Procedures Act under the rules of the Workers' Compensation Commission. Now you have the rules of the State Office of Administrative Hearings governing, not the rules of the Workers' Compensation Commission. I believe the rules of the Workers' Compensation Commission, as applied, did not give fair hearing.
Why not?
Because it doesn't allow you to engage them in discovery, adequate discovery. In addition, what the Workers' Compensation Commission did, and it was in Rule 145.18, I believe, they said specifically that only the paper file that was produced at the first level of medical review was all that could be considered in the subsequent hearing. So you did not have a de novo hearing. You did not have the right to the hearing, but the Administrative Procedure Act specifically says that you did. So if you look at the Workers' Compensation Commission rule as they apply up until January 1st of 1998, when SOA changed its rules, you could not offer an additional evidence other than presenting the paper file to the Workers' Compensation Commission unless you had a hearing before SOA and were able to show good cause within a certain time frame why you should be allowed to put on evidence. So you didn't have an opportunity to post witnesses. You did not have an opportunity to engage in discovery.
Since the rules have been changed, is the process given now adequate?
In my opinion, no, Your Honor.
What's wrong with the current?
Because I believe when you have a governmental, a state agency saying what the law is, you need to have, for purposes of public policy, judicial review of that agency's decision. This agency has told you that if you grant a right of medical, of judicial review in medical disputes, the district courts of Travis County are going to be flooded with medical cases. But the reason there are 25,000 supposed medical disputes out there is because the Workers' Compensation Commission ignores its own rule, 133.305A, which says there's a one-year statute of limitations. If you looked in the brief and you look at the appendices, you will see how the commission has ignored that rule, has gone back and forth saying, well, yes, we will consider some of these. Well, no, we'll consider some of these over here. No, we're not going to consider these. Oh, we changed our mind. Yes, we are. And I believe that you have, for public policy purposes, you must have judicial review of agency decisions. As the
in all circumstances, the procedure followed by the agency can never satisfy due process, in your view?
In my opinion, Your Honor, based on my experience, it cannot. I know that may seem like an extreme position, but I do not believe that it does. If I would urge the court, in looking at what is going on as to how this agency interprets the Act, they ignore the plain meaning of the Act.
If your position is adopted, doesn't it have implications and impact a whole lot bigger than just the issue we're talking about? If we rule your way, what that means is that in every administrative ruling henceforth, not just involving workers' comp, but every single administrative ruling, there's going to have to be a right of judicial review. If it's not otherwise included in the statute, we're going to have to say automatically you get a right of review to determine at a minimum whether or not what the administrative agency did was arbitrary and capricious.
May I answer your question?
Sure.
Your Honor, yes, as to the first part, but the savings clause in the second part is the legislature can come in as it has in a number of acts and specifically say there is not a right of review from these proceedings. Otherwise, I believe the Administrative Procedures Act, as I said in the brief, does indeed grant that entitlement.
So what you're saying is that if the legislature specifically says there is no right of review, then you wouldn't be entitled to an inherent judicial right of review.
I'm a little confused, Your Honor.
You said that what I proposed would happen would not occur if the legislature specifically said in a statute that there is no judicial right of review from this administrative proceeding.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that applies, but if the legislature doesn't say that, they just don't provide a right of review, then there is one.
I think the Administrative Procedures Act clearly says that. I recognize that the courts of appeal in Austin has consistently held that it doesn't. And I recognize, as the commission stated in its brief, that this court has, I believe, denied writ in some of those cases. But there is cases from, I know, the Court of Appeals in Waco that clearly held that the Administrative Procedures Act does grant a general entitlement to judicial review. If I may indulge the court, or if you would indulge me rather, if you look at 401.021A, which talks about how the Administrative Procedures Act applies to the Workers' Compensation Act. And when you look at the Breyer case, which is the Breyer versus employee retirement case, that the language is very similar. And the court there held that, yes, it does give a right of judicial review. A case called Texas Health Facilities Commission versus West Texas, that was a Court of Appeals decision out of Waco, said that almost same identical language that's found in the Workers' Compensation Act granted a right of judicial review because it talks about substantial evidence. If you look at 410.255B, it talks about substantial evidence. And that's been held by the courts to say that is granting the right of review. And I would urge this court and my client to pray that you reverse the Court of Appeals and find that there is a right of review under the Workers' Compensation Act, not just for medical benefit disputes, but for all disputes under the Act.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Dewey, Helen Camp will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I am Dewey Helmkamp, an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Texas, representing the Workers' Compensation Commission in this proceeding. Before I begin the formal part of my argument, I would like to expressly state to the court what it is that the Commission seeks from this proceeding today. First, we are asking that the court affirm that portion of the Third Court of Appeals opinion, which expressly held that the Texas Labor Code, the Workers' Compensation Act, does not grant a statutory right of review for such medical disputes as are at issue in this case. Second, we respectfully ask that this court reverse that portion of the Third Court of Appeals opinion which held that there was an inherent right of judicial review because there was a vested property right at stake. The Commission filed its petition for review on that point, and I should like to address it now. But before I do so, I do need to respond to one inaccuracy that my good friend and colleague Mr. John Pringle made. I would point out in response to the Justice's question about whether or not the APA applied to this particular proceeding, the answer is an unequivocal yes. You may determine this by reviewing the petitioner's brief. I believe it's one of the first appendices attached to the Continental Casualty brief. It is, in fact, a copy of the decision and order that was rendered by the APA hearing officer at the Commission. I point out at that time in 1994, the Commission hired and employed trained lawyers to act as APA hearings officers for such cases. In that order, the very first paragraph, it says, if I may quote briefly, this case is decided under the Texas Workers' Compensation Act and cites the Labor Code, then the Administrative Procedures Act. And you may find this in the materials. The point is simply in response to the Justice's question, the protections, if you will, the procedural safeguards provided by the legislature and the APA were in fact present in this case. What has happened in 1995, the legislature chose to shift the hearing responsibilities from the internal hearings officers, employees of the Commission, and transferred those responsibilities to the State Office of Administrative Hearings, which, as you know, is an independent cadre of administrative law judges that hear such cases for state agencies. I should now like to return, if I may, to the position of the Commission as to why the Court of Appeals erred in finding that there was a vested property right in this case.
Before you do that, let me ask you something about that order you were referring to a second ago.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you would look at the last page with the hearing officer's signature.
Let me get the order back to the last page of the order.
Uh-huh.
I have it, Your Honor.
What's the meaning of that fine print at the bottom?
I understand. I know what you're going to ask, and if I may anticipate and answer the question, you're wondering why in the world do we say in there that there's a right of judicial review? Two answers at least come to mind. Number one, the Commission, frankly, was operating at that time under a misapprehension that there was a right of judicial review. It took this case, quite frankly, in the inquiry of the trial judge, Judge Margaret Cooper, who first raised for us the issue of jurisdiction. When she did that, the Commission reviewed this and carefully looking at the statute itself, and particularly Section 410.255 and the other sections that are preceded and follow it, the Commission took the position and realized that it had in fact, was an error. And this statement that a party aggrieved, dissatisfied with this judicial decision, excuse me, a party dissatisfied with this decision may take judicial review by filing a petition, etc., was in error. Now, I will tell you, to this day, because of the pendency of this case, that language still appears in the order. We haven't changed it because we don't know what this court is going to decide, but we have changed our position, and we are now stating to this court that there is no right of judicial review. I would also point out the second reason in response to your question. An agency does not have the power to independently grant judicial review if the legislature hasn't given it. I mean, it's axiomatic that agencies only have those powers which are given to them by the legislature. And even if we wanted to do this, we don't have the power to do it. So it's frankly just a mistake, plain and simple. If I may return to my argument on the vested property right, it primarily rests on two principles. The Court of Appeals wrote what we respectfully submit as a very well-reasoned opinion on this point, but their analysis stopped short, because here's what they said, and this is at page 781 of the Court of Appeals opinion in footnote or paragraph 10. They say, in the present case, we must first identify the affected interest. Well, we certainly agree with that. A person's property interests include actual ownership of real estate, chattels, and money, and we agree with that. The property interest at issue in this case involves the money that the Commission's hearing officer ordered Continental to pay to FRA and Pride. We don't disagree with that. But the next sentence is problematic. The court said, it is self-evident that a party has a vested property right in his own money. We do not disagree with that statement, but the problem is the Court of Appeals stopped short in its analysis. What they should have gone on to do is analyze the context in which this case arises, the context in which the money is affected. And that context is critical because this is a highly regulated economic endeavor. It is a statutory scheme created by the legislature to provide for all manner of resolution of all manner of issues arising under the workers' compensation laws of this state. So, to be a vested property right and have that right in one's money, the courts have also held that one must have an unfettered interest in that money and the ability to use it as one sees fit. Under the context of this case, and this is our critical point, at least the first point, Continental Casualty did not have an unfettered interest or discretion in that money. That money came from premiums paid by the injured worker's employer for a policy of workers' compensation insurance. Continental Casualty had agreed to abide by and be bound by the rules of the Workers' Compensation Commission as set forth by its duly authorized enactments as well as by the statutory scheme. It was responsible and held that money almost in trust, I use that word advisedly, for the payment of such claims, such benefits as may be ordered by the Commission pursuant to the scheme. So the first point is Continental Casualty did not in fact have, as the law contemplates, a vested interest in this money. But secondly, as this court held in 1916 in the seminal case of Middleton, which I believe to be the first case testing the newly enacted workers' compensation law of this state. Now, it wasn't called that at the time, but that's what it was. In Middleton, as you know, the court looked at the statutory scheme which the legislature created to settle some of these issues. Each of the parties in the workers' compensation scheme gave up something. The injured worker gave up his or her right to sue the employer as that right existed in common law in return for certain benefits which would be paid if that employee suffered an on-the-job injury. In return, the employer gave up certain rights that it had, such as the common law defenses of contributory negligence or assumption of the risk. And initially, they weren't insurance companies involved in the process, but over time, insurance companies took the place of the initial statutory scheme to provide that coverage. The point is that the Middleton case stands for the proposition that employers who become subscribers under the Act voluntarily waive the right to have their liability determined in the courts. So too do the other parties in the system, and we now suggest that is in fact Continental Casualty, by voluntarily participating in the workers' compensation system, and it has absolutely no obligation to do so, but by its voluntary participation in the system, Continental Casualty has, like the Texas Power and Light Company in Middleton, voluntarily given up its right to have its liability determined by the courts of this state.
Are you thoroughly familiar with the insurance agreement issued by Continental Casualty?
I respectfully say I am not that familiar with the actual insurance contract, Judge.
So you don't know if it says anything in there about whether or not they are subject to the procedures set out in either the labor code or the APA or anything like that?
I do not. I suspect that given the standardization of most insurance policies, especially in the workers' comp field, there probably is not such language. But I do suggest that by agreeing to write workers' comp insurance in the state, Continental Casualty, as approximately 580-some other insurance companies that write workers' comp coverage, agree to be bound and to follow the workers' compensation system enacted by the legislature.
So under your argument, the legislature could pass an act that kept both claimants and their opponents out of the courts altogether?
In fact, not only that they could do that, Judge, but they have in fact done that in this statute.
I thought there was substantial judicial review in this statute.
Well, and that is the point that Continental Casualty sought to raise, and which I believe, if I understand your question, was rejected by the Third Court. The legislature in crafting this act in 1989, which was a complete rewrite, as you know, of the workers' compensation law, and then subsequently was recodified into the labor code, the legislature, for whatever reason, chose for this particular type of dispute, that is an issue between a health care provider and an insurance company over whether the insurance company had to pay the health care provider, the legislature chose not to allow for judicial review of that case.
As I understand, your argument from Middleton is that the legislature could deprive all participants in the compensation process any judicial review. And in Garcia, we said no.
I think that would be perhaps a reach. It would be too far to go. And let me tell you what I mean. There are, as someone pointed out, administrative safeguards and due process provisions that are provided. Both they were provided in 1994 when this case arose, and they are still provided today by the Administrative Procedures Act. There's notice, there's opportunity to be heard, there's full discovery, depositions, request for production of documents, representation by counsel, argument, full and impartial hearing, et cetera, et cetera. But suppose, Your Honor, the situation arose where, say, Continental Casualty was aggrieved by a decision of the the dispute resolution process. Remember, there's a two-tier process before the commission. And suppose Continental Casualty exercised the right, which the legislature did give it, to ask for a contested case hearing. Suppose further that for some reason when Continental Casualty gave notice to FRA of that hearing, by certified mail return receipt requested, somebody else signed that green card by mistake, and in actuality, Continental Casualty never got the notice. Under the SOA rules, you may be surprised to learn, it's particularly SOA rule 155.55, if a party comes to the contested case hearing and can establish that actual notice was given, usually by the return receipt requested, and that other party has failed to appear, a default judgment may be taken. And suppose that happens. Suppose that FRA, again in my example, did not get the notice because the green card was signed for mistakenly by somebody else. Continental Casualty shows up at the hearing, but FRA is not there. They proceed to take a default judgment, and only after the fact does FRA find out about it. In that instance, I believe, and this is the answer to your question, I do believe and would assert that FRA would have a right to get to the courthouse to say, wait a minute, a substantial due process right of mine was violated because I didn't get notice. And I need to have the court look at that.
Is there any other issue that the commission decides that is not subject to judicial review?
At this moment, I am unaware of any other issues that are decided that are not subject to judicial review.
Why would the legislature make this the one? To the surprise of the commission, apparently.
I think, Your Honor, if I knew the answer to that, I think I could make a great living as a lobbyist trying to figure out what legislative intent was. I suspect, though, in reality, when the legislature looked at this, to the extent that it truly, you know, in reality, truly thought about it, I suspect they just felt that this was not one of those issues that was of significant importance and magnitude to require further scrutiny by the court. I suspect, and this again is just one person's opinion, but I suspect this kind of a dispute was not of that import. In other words, we have a $2,400 issue here.
But how much in total in the course of a year goes through this process in medical dispute?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
you. How much money is involved in the disputes that are resolved by this process administratively every year? I mean, each claim may be small, but what's the total amount of money involved?
Each case, of course, is different, and there are varying amounts. I can tell you that in this particular case, $2,400 was at issue. The basic premise very quickly is, what happened in this case is Mr. Hood went to...
No, I understand that, okay. But when you start adding up all the medical dispute claims that are processed every year, what is the total, approximately, of money in dispute that the procedure resolves the dispute?
I simply do not have that figure at this moment. If the court would like, I'll try to provide it for you in a short letter after the proceeding, but I...
The insurance fund says $88 million.
I can tell you that what I do know, that with regard to approximately 25,000 claims that are presently pending at the commission as a result of the invalidation of the 1992 hospital fee guideline, there is approximately, I think, $200 million in additional claims that hospitals have filed. There's a total of about 25,000 claims seeking additional reimbursement for the difference between what they were paid under that hospital fee guideline and what they would receive had they been paid what they charged. But other than that, Your Honor, I don't have any further information.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that before the current act, these issues were subject to judicial review?
I do. That is correct.
Let me take you, in the moments that remain, to the APA. The language seems awfully clear that everyone who has is agreed by a final decision in a contested case is entitled to judicial review.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I have several responses to that. Number one, you need to look at I would begin with section 2001.001 of the APA. That is the purpose. The purpose is the public policy of the state through this chapter to, one, provide minimum standards of uniform practice and procedure for state agencies. Two, to provide for public participation in the rulemaking process. And three, to restate the law of judicial review of state agency action. I think that's critical. It's not to allow for judicial review. It is to restate the law. Then if you look at the specific provision cited by the petitioners, section 2001.171, the critical language, I believe, is the last three words of that subsection, which says, under this chapter. I believe, and the courts have previously held since 1979, that the Administrative Procedures Act is simply, as regards this particular subsection, a procedural guideline to direct the steps which are undertaken when judicial review is expressly authorized by some other law. I would point also the court to section 2001.172. It's entitled the scope of judicial review. If I may, it's one sentence. It says, the scope of judicial review of a state agency decision in a contested case is as provided by the law under which review is sought. That tells me, and it tells administrative law practitioners, really since the APA was enacted, that what you do is you go to the agency's enabling statute, and you must then determine, does the agency's enabling statute grant the right of judicial review? I would also point out one other subsection. It's 2001.174. This is review under substantial evidence rule or undefined scope of review. If the law authorizes review of a decision in a contested case under the substantial evidence rule, or if the law does not define it, so on and so forth.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Any other questions? Thank you.
With your permission, Your Honor, just a few points in rebuttal, especially in regard to the due process question, whether sufficient procedural due process is provided to the parties at the administrative level. Let's not lose sight of the fact that due process has two prongs, procedural, which really isn't an issue in this case, and substantive. And the substantive prong is what's most troublesome here, because the substantive prong is what protects the citizens of the state from arbitrary and capricious actions of a state agency and just plain wrong decisions. We've already had at least one case in Travis County District Court where a district judge, in fact, under substantial evidence standards, remarkably remanded a case to the State Office of Administrative Hearings on a question of interpretation of the law. So this is very important. Secondly, in regard to the number of disputes, I think at least one carrier, I think it was in the amicus brief, stated they had 400,000 medical bills processed. Those bills have to be processed under the medical fee guidelines promulgated by the commission, and the commission becomes its own policeman without the right to judicial review. In regard to the flooding of the court and the citing of the Blair case, Blair dealt with an express exclusion in the statute of the right to judicial review, and is distinguishable because of that. And the commission's reliance on Middleton, I think, is also misplaced, because that case dealt with whether defenses could be taken away constitutionally from an employer.
Can I ask you a question? Does the APA is the only one that provides for review based on an arbitrary and capricious standard of review. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. I believe 410.255 restates the provisions of the APA and also provides for arbitrary capricious.
So whether it's under the Compensation Act or the APA, an arbitrary and capricious standard review is available?
Yes, sir.
And is it your argument that that's what that standard review gives you the benefit of the vested property right?
Yes, sir. I believe that the legislature would not have deliberately passed an unconstitutional statute. If we have a deprivation of substantive due process rights, that may be what has happened here. They would recognize, of course, the inherent right to judicial review.
What about his argument that this is really not a vested property right?
I think he's simply wrong. I think it's a very convoluted reasoning to say that money, the most basic of possessions, is not vested because it's somehow subject to a regulatory system. If that's true, none of our dollars are vested either because they're subject to the Internal Revenue Service.
But
all of us are regulated.
But if it's a vested property right, that entitles you to due process, doesn't it?
Yes, sir, both substantive and procedural.
And due process is something that can only happen in a court.
Yes, sir.
That's
well, not only in a court, but here we have to have a review of an agency decision. You can have
well, you've got an appellate review. You have an appellate review of that decision. What you're asking is an additional court review of the review, don't you?
No, sir. There is no appellate review for medical benefits disputes. There is
no instance. Once the hearing officer makes the decision, you can't go to the commission and there's no appellate panel that reviews.
Not for medical benefits, and that's what causes some confusion. For income benefits that claimants are entitled to, there's an additional tier in the process. There's the benefit review conference, which is a mediation. There's the benefit contested case hearing, which is conducted not under the APA, but under specific rules of commission. Then there's a right to go to an appeals panel within the commission to appeal that, and they primarily are concerned with errors in law. They don't much look at the factual considerations. And then you get to go to district court. What's missing in the medical benefit side of that tree is any kind of appellate review of the contested case decision.
But you've already had a benefits review decision that you weren't satisfied with, so you created a contested case and went to the hearing officer.
The distinction I think that's important here is that benefit review doesn't involve the presentation of any evidence. It's simply a submission of documents to the commission saying, oh, commission, please order that, for example, the carrier pay me. There's no evidence taken. The officers reviewing them aren't lawyers. They're not medically trained. They're not judges. They are called medical review officers. So it's an initial determination, which is then reviewed now by the State Office of Administrative Hearings.
You get a review of that decision by a hearing officer. One of your complaints is you don't get another review of that.
The Medical Review Division doesn't do what we would normally consider practicing law.
I understand that's your argument. Your point is that there's other levels of review that you ought to be entitled to in the process.
Yes,
and ultimately, if regardless of how many levels of review you get, due process is denied by not being allowed to go to court.
Yes, sir. The substantive due process part of the
presentation
is most important.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the first clause will take a 3 minutes.
All right.